Australia, we have dedicated centers now to gaming addiction.
Oh, that's very good.
Yeah, so where parents bringing their kids, like, okay, my child is addicted.
And does that work?
It does work, yeah. They put them through programs and stuff like that. It works. So, you know, they change a lot of things in their life, like their foods, their stuff. They take them out. They mm-hmm. Like, they would have certain programs that keeps them
they
occupied.
Replace other
they,
activities.
Yeah, they kind of get their mind back to a normal state where they're not
back
no
to
longer
reality.
Back to reality. So they're no longer... but that's a problem, though. We have the meta things
metaverse,
coming. Metaverse
yes,
coming. That's
yes.
going to be a problem.
That's going to make it deeper and deeper.
We're trying to bring people back to reality. They're putting them back into, what do you call it?
They take them forth into future. So we were talking about metaverse that is going to take us into a new world, which is going to be more addictive.
So we want to bring them back to reality.
Yes.
They want to take them into virtual reality, which is not real. That's
yes.
the word I'm after. Virtual
yes.
reality. Where we live in a virtual reality now where everything doesn't seem to be realistic mm-hmm. enough. And we seem to enjoy it. So if this metaverse comes in and they want to say, you know what? You don't even need to interact with people anymore. You
yes.
can just live inside your glasses and talk and do things. That's a problem.
And since it's going to be very interesting, then we are going to put much time on that.
Yeah. Have you watched a TV series called Black Window?
Why? How does it relate to metaverse and...
Okay, because Black Window, it's a series about how futuristic things mm-hmm. could become reality. Like you put a chip on your brain and then your eyes kind of black out and then you just completely got into another like a virtual reality thing
sure.
where it's very realistic mm-hmm. and what you feel in that reality, virtual reality, your body could actually sense it and feels it too.
Mm-hmm.
Which if this becomes a reality, that becomes a problem.
Yeah.
Like if they actually work it, develop it. Like, I mean, I know like Facebook is working mm-hmm. on the metaverse, which if it becomes reality, you have millions of people
yes.
in their glasses instead of being outside.
And then you would sleep on the sofa and then you would have those glasses on your eyes and life stops.
Exactly.
You would
sorry,
go into
I do
the
apologize.
World.
It was the series called Black Mirror, not Black Window. Black Mirror.
Yes.
Right?
So I should watch that.
You should. But I mean, like, if this is if this is what we're headed,
mm-hmm.
we can have a problem. So that
of
could
course.
Be
so because
that's an addiction.
Right now,
because people right now are addicted to Facebook,
yes.
aren't they?
Yes. We cannot solve this addiction. Now another, a bigger addiction comes in.
Yeah, so the addiction itself is kind of evolving.
Yes,
from
it's evolving.
Just crawling with your fingers. Mm-hmm. Like if for those who are addicted to Facebook, there are those who are addicted to TikTok. There
yes.
are those who are addicted to YouTube. Those who are addicted to Snapchat.
But there are ways to control it, you know. I remember there was a month when I had to study pretty much stronger than other times. Then what I did was that I devoted a special time. I said, you can have only 1 hour each night to go through social
media.
So
that's a reward system. You're rewarding yourself.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I said, you do all your jobs, and then after you finish, you would reward yourself in a way that you could go for your cell phone and go through social media. That was the way I healed myself for only a month, and then after that, when I everything was smoother,
when you
and
school,
I had
you went back to your addiction
because I had much more time. You know what makes things terrible is your free time. If you do not plan for your free time, you get stuck with addiction.
Okay, that's a problem.
There are addictions for you.
Yeah, but then addiction, they fill up your time and you say, I have no time left.
You know yes, what I mean? That's
like,
true.
Like, my time is full. I got no time. What are you doing?
Nothing.
I'm just watching TV. I'm
yes.
just going through Netflix
I'm doing
series
nothing,
after
yet
series
I'm so
after
busy.
Series. Yeah, I have that disease. Okay.
Yes. May right, God well, bless us all.
I mean, yeah, we definitely need to take the addiction seriously, especially when it comes
yes.
to time. I think that consume our time management, it will have devastating effect on our careers,
mm-hmm.
on our brains, on our families, on our kids. So addiction these days are just, to me, it's just as deadly as cancer.
Exactly.
Because if you're not active, you're just as good as dead. I always remember this saying that one guy said once, he said, if you're not giving extra to life, you are extra on life. So we have millions of people who are extra on life. They're not doing anything good to life, rather than they sucking the life out of life.
Yes, you know what I mean? Unfortunately, sometimes we turn into just beings who are breathing. That's what we do.
That's a big problem.
All right. Yes.
Well, I think that's all the time we have for today. All right. Thank you guys for listening. Inshallah, we will get back to you in another program. Stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The invaders should know that the Ansarullah are earnest in their efforts for peace and national reconciliation among the people of Yemen without any outside interference through any council of stooges, and have the retaliatory power to strike with forceful vengeance that might result in changes to the map of Arabia. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading Stooge Replaced by Seven Stooges. Stay tuned for more. Frustration leads to desperation and ends in self-destruction, especially when a regime which lacks legitimacy in the land, which it forcibly rules with the help of hegemons, attempts to impose its own mini-hegemony through mercenaries on a sovereign, independent country. The above could be an apt description of British-created and US-backed Saudi Arabia, which has trapped itself in Yemen and unable to extricate itself from the quagmire of the war it launched in 2015 in an abortive bid to dislodge the popular Ansarullah movement by propping up a fugitive from justice, has replaced him with a team of seven stooges in the vain hope of either a face-saving exit or more devastation of its southern neighbor, little knowing that the retaliatory power of the defenders could disintegrate the kingdom of minority Wahhabi cult. On paper, Riyadh's resident Mansour Hadi, who had no power whatsoever despite claiming to be president of Yemen, has handed over his fictitious authority to seven mostly military figures selected by his Saudi host, and not the least nominated by the people of Yemen. It means the newly formed council does not represent the Yemeni people and is continuation of the imposed illegitimacy to carry on the designs of the invaders in Arab world's most impoverished country. One positive aspect of the farcical Saudi move, however, is that there is no pretense now for sponsors of Riyadh's war against the national government in Sana'a, as well as the UN, which claims to be neutral, to style themselves as backers of the so-called internationally supported government of Yemen. In the words of Ansarullah spokesman Mohammad Abdussalam in his Twitter message recently, the international community and the UN no longer have an excuse to continue using the term internationally recognized Yemeni government to massacre the Yemeni people and enforce a tight siege on Yemen. He also made it clear that the future of Yemen will be determined only by the people of Yemen and not through any spurious talks conducted in Riyadh by Saudi Arabia, adding, "The Yemeni nation does not care about the talks sponsored by illegal parties. The only option for the Saudi-led coalition to promote peace is to stop its attacks, lift its siege, and move out its forces. Other than that, claims to settle the conflict are nothing but desperate attempts to regroup mercenaries and use them to escalate the tensions." If Saudi Arabia and the UAE, its comrades in crimes against the Yemeni people, are wise, they will avail the two-month truce to review their suicidal step of starting the war and stop following the instructions of the Americans, the British, and the Zionists. Of course, the war indemnity they would have to eventually pay for destruction wrought on Yemen's infrastructure will definitely not compensate the catastrophic loss of 400,000 Yemeni lives. The invaders should know that. The Ansarullah are earnest in their efforts for peace and national reconciliation among the people of Yemen without any outside interference through any Council of Stooges, and have the retaliatory power to strike with forceful vengeance that might result in changes to the map of Arabia.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the philosophy of fasting. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. You may be wondering why your Muslim neighbor, friend, or co-worker has to fast the entire month of Ramadan. There are many reasons and benefits to fasting, brothers and sisters. Some are spiritual and some of social nature. Let's discuss the spiritual dimension first. The fasting during the month of Ramadan is not for atonement or repentance. It is not a sort of punishment. It is a religious ritual for a positive purpose. In the Holy Quran, mentioning fasting, Almighty Allah says, so that hopefully you may guard yourself against displeasing God. This is also translated as, you may become pious or more aware of Allah. This points to the spiritual purpose of fasting, which one can very comfortably argue is the real goal of fasting. Don't look at fasting as some sort of an obligation, something you're forced into, something you don't want to do but you are required to do. No, brothers and sisters, think about it. It is an opportunity that Allah wishes for His beloved servants to benefit from. Why can't we look at fasting with this lens and with this perspective? Now, all of a sudden, everything changes, right? We go to work. Nobody likes to go to work, you know, generally speaking. But we go there because we know that this work, this employment, this job is going to provide for my expenses. And I would have a decent life with my family. Hence, we, every morning, go to work. Similarly, if we know that there are unlimited spiritual benefits that fasting is offering to us, why in the world would we not stay hungry and thirsty and abide by the rules of fasting in Islam? It is a common sense and a very easy decision to make, only if you think about it. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the philosophy of fasting, and we said that there are two major dimensions to fasting. One dimension is the spiritual dimension, and the other dimension is social in nature. Today we are trying to go through the spiritual dimension and understand the benefit and the philosophy behind the prescription of fasting by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Let me now explain the spiritual dimension of fasting. As we all know, Allah has created various powers within us. On the one hand, we have soul, the conscience, the spiritual dimension. And on the other hand, Allah has also created the elements of anger and desire in us. Anger is the power that repels whatever we think to be harmful to ourselves. And desire is the element within us which attracts whatever we perceive to be beneficial to us. There is a constant struggle between the soul, the conscience, and reason. And on the other hand, and the powers of anger and physical desires, on the other hand, they also have a fight. Constant struggle. All our emotions and physical desires can be classified under anger and desire. But these dimensions of human life are important for our survival in this world. However, Islam says that a successful human being is a person who controls the powers of anger and desire by the means of his soul. Not just soul, along with soul, there is conscience or reason. Only by controlling, not totally suppressing, the anger and the desire can a person attain a balanced personality. Islam wants its followers to be in control of their lives and not become slaves of their desires. This is indeed the major jihad in Islam. By major jihad, we mean the spiritual struggle which goes within each one of us. The holy month of Ramadan provides us with this opportunity. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The world will never forget the gruesome killing of outspoken journalist Jamal Khashoggi by a Saudi hit squad in 2018. Khashoggi was strangled at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and then dismembered by a forensic scientist who worked for Saudi intelligence. The killing was caught on listening devices planted by Turkish intelligence. The Saudi dissident's body was then cut to pieces and taken to the Turkish Consul General's residence, where it is believed to have been burned. No remains have ever been found. The brutal murder severely strained ties between Ankara and Riyadh and led to an unofficial Saudi boycott of Turkish exports. It cut Ankara's exports to Riyadh by 90%. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was particularly vociferous in his condemnation of the Saudi government. He said Khashoggi was killed in cold blood by a death squad sent from Riyadh, and that it had been established that his murder was premeditated. The Turkish president said the operation had been ordered at the highest levels of the Saudi government. His assessment was supported by a U.S. intelligence report which said Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had personally approved the assassination. There has been almost no doubt that the order to kill came from very high up in the Saudi government. And Turkey was widely seen as the most unrelenting force behind efforts to bring those responsible for the assassination to justice. But Ankara has suddenly changed course. On Thursday, a Turkish court halted the trial of Saudi suspects and transferred the case to Saudi Arabia. The Turkish court's ruling has been widely denounced. Rights groups called the move an appalling whitewash. Khashoggi's Turkish fiancée says she has been surprised and saddened by the decision, which she described as political. Following the court's ruling, Hatice Cengiz said Saudi Arabia is a country where there is no justice and that no one expects a just decision there. She also pledged to appeal the court ruling. The Turkish U-turn on the murder trial comes as President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is trying to mend ties with the Saudis. The Khashoggi case has been a major obstacle to warmer political relations between the two sides. But why does Turkey need to reset its ties with the oil-rich kingdom so much? Turkey is grappling with a severe economic downturn, and the Turkish leader is facing an election next year.
I think it has everything to do with trying to mend ties with Saudi Arabia. I think Turkey has been chasing reconciliation with its former antagonist. We've seen that it's reconciled with the UAE. We've seen that it's been making concessions to Egypt, that it's been restricting the activity of Egyptian opposition in Istanbul and telling Egyptian opposition critics in Istanbul to tone down their criticism of Sisi in a bid to try to get Egypt to accept a reconciliation. And likewise, we're seeing Turkey make strenuous efforts in order to convince Mohammed bin Salman to end the Saudi boycott of Turkish goods.
Riyadh had made it clear to Ankara that a thaw could only come if Ankara drops the case against the kingdom. The Turkish court's ruling has left little doubt that cash-strapped Ankara wants a thaw in ties with the wealthy Saudis to such an extent that it is willing to drop the high-profile case for good.
So what Turkey is essentially doing, it's handing the issue over to Saudi Arabia and saying, for us, the matter is closed, and we're going to allow you to close the matter as well permanently, so that nobody officially in the international community can talk about Khashoggi anymore.
Saudi petrodollars seem to be once again giving the kingdom impunity for its horrific crimes.
Russia has warned the West against disrupting peace talks with Ukraine. Foreign Minister Lavrov says Russia believes the West is enabling hysteria around the alleged mass killings in the Ukrainian town to derail the peace talks between Moscow and Kiev. We tend to think that the reason lies in the desire to find a reason to disrupt the ongoing negotiations, and to do it exactly at the moment when, as they say, the light, even if not bright, but nevertheless began to dawn. According to Lavrov, in the course of negotiations with Russia, Kiev had for the first time put on paper its readiness to declare itself neutral, not aligned to any bloc, and non-nuclear. Lavrov insisted that the Ukrainians had formalized a refusal to deploy the weapons of foreign states on their territory or to conduct exercises there with the participation of a foreign military without the consent of all guarantor states of the future treaty, including Russia. The remarks by the Russian top diplomats highlight the possibility that Ukraine's Western backers may have different motivations or reservations about a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. For some NATO countries, the war between Ukraine and Russia is preferable to a peace deal.
Well, obviously, Ukraine is being utilized by NATO in a very dangerous experiment. And it's not the first time this has happened. This has really been kind of a century-old project dating back to after the First World War, when there was an attempt to prevent the growth of large major countries like Germany and Russia, so that Central Europe has always been used by, in those days, by the British and these days by the Americans as a wedge against any major country that might become a competitor.
There is a long track record of influential foreign policy thinkers who suggested America would benefit from Russia fighting an insurgency in Ukraine. The latest official to express the benefits of Ukrainian insurgency is U.S. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Colin Carl. I think with a high degree of certainty that Russia will emerge from Ukraine weaker than it went into the conflict. Militarily weaker, economically weaker, politically and geopolitically weaker, and more isolated.
Unfortunately, the United States is continuing to work, as they did after World War II in Ukraine, against the Soviet Union, to ally themselves with extremely right-wing forces who earlier had been associated with the Nazis. And that is a real factor in Ukraine. And it's undeniable. And the United States is playing with them as a tool in a game against Russia. It's hard to say what the end game there is.
U.S. officials say they are skeptical that the Ukrainian government's negotiations with Russia will lead to a swift deal. And they are considering how a settlement will impact the security of NATO nations. Some European countries, especially formerly communist ones, are especially nervous about how the conflict will evolve. They believe if Russia feels it has profited from the invasion, it may eventually be inspired to try the same thing against other neighbors. NATO leaders say the Ukrainians are involved in a broader fight on behalf of Europe. Even a Ukrainian vow not to join NATO could be a concern for some neighbors. Therefore, it appears that for some in NATO, it's better for the Ukrainians to keep fighting and dying than to achieve peace. They believe the peace deal would come too early or at too high a cost to Kiev and the rest of Europe. European members themselves do not appear united on how much of a direct threat Russia poses to the alliance. Germany and France are more inclined than their allies in Eastern Europe to feel that Moscow's aims stop at the NATO border. For countries that are closer to the war, there is a belief that they have more at stake.
Violent clashes between Sri Lankan police and anti-government protesters across the country have become commonplace in recent days. The protesters are angry at the government's handling of the country's worst economic crisis since its 1948 independence from the United Kingdom. The economic downturn has led to long lines for fuel, a short supply of essential goods, and seven-hour-long power cuts every day. The protesters are calling on President Gotabaya Rajapaksa to resign. The president, however, remains defiant. He declared a state of emergency on Friday and announced a curfew to quell the protests. However, the demonstrations show no sign of dying down anytime soon. The government blames the COVID-19 pandemic for the devaluation of the national currency and other economic woes. It says the outbreak has slashed revenues from tourism and the inward flow of foreign exchanges. But that's not the whole picture, at least according to economic experts.
The situation has been exacerbated in Sri Lanka due to the mismanagement, the political crisis, the corruption. The president and the prime minister are brothers. One of the nephews is a minister in the government. So it's, you know, it's extraordinary sort of nepotism which is happening in Sri Lanka. So that's one of the contributory factors.
A government expenditure that exceeds its income, ill-timed tax cuts, and a sudden shift toward organic farming that hamstrung the food industry in the country are also cited as reasons why the Sri Lankan economy is now in the doldrums. Sri Lanka is facing imminent default, with over $7 billion of debt due this year, $1 billion of which are international bonds that will mature in July. This is while the country's usable currency reserves are estimated to have fallen to as low as $500 million. To stave off defaulting on its debt, Colombo has turned to regional superpowers, India and China, for bailout loans, securing a $1 billion credit line from the New Delhi late last month. But that's far from enough, which leaves Sri Lanka with not many more alternatives than the International Monetary Fund. But securing a loan from the IMF will come at a cost too, as the international lender would require Sri Lanka to implement fundamental changes to its fiscal and economic policies, something that experts believe would put much more pressure on the poor. Besides, as some commentators suggest, the demanded restructuring could infringe on Colombo's sovereignty.
As soon as IMF loans money to any nation, they want austerity measures. What that means in simple language is they want subsidies to be taken away from basic things that ordinary people use. Because what you've got to remember that in a developing country like Sri Lanka, the main budget of the ordinary masses is on food and accommodation and energy. They don't have any sort of residual income to buy luxuries. And if inflation goes up by 40% in these sectors, then it has a huge impact on the ordinary people.
No matter what route the country will choose, one thing is for certain. As long as the current economic climate stands, the developing nations would suffer under skyrocketing consumer prices, fuel shortages, and power cuts, which means more protests and political uncertainty in the indebted nations.
The holy month of Ramadan has begun for Muslims around the world. However, some struggle to observe it under inhumane conditions. Palestinians are facing a new round of escalations while being subjected to a blockade. The number of Palestinians killed so far this week has reached 10. The Gaza Strip-based Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, and the West Bank-headquartered Palestinian Authority have slammed the Israeli regime over its earlier targeted killing of Palestinian youths. In a statement, Palestinian presidential spokesman Nabil Abu Radeina said the ongoing escalation would blow up the situation in Palestine and the entire region. This came after Israel's occupation forces shot dead three Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin on Saturday, amid the escalation of Israeli violence in the Palestinian territories. Israeli forces assassinated the trio by opening fire on their vehicle near the city of Jenin in the northern West Bank. They later seized the vehicle and the bodies of the three people. Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of Islamic Jihad, identified the victims as its members. Palestinian resistance groups, Islamic Jihad and Hamas have vowed that such atrocious acts will not go unpunished.
If the Israelis see Ramadan as an opportunity when Palestinians, especially Palestinians who are associated with resistance groups, if they see this as an opportunity for them to be gathered with their families, then they become targets, and their families become targets. So this is unfortunately something for the Israelis. This may be considered an opportunity to be more repressive than usual.
Palestinians were brutally attacked by Israeli regime forces at the Damascus Gate of the occupied Al-Quds on the second night of the holy month of Ramadan as well. It is customary for Israeli forces to exhibit increased levels of violence against Palestinians gathering in the area during the fasting month of Ramadan. At least 20 Palestinians were injured in the clashes and 10 were detained. Israeli forces have recently intensified their violent raids on Palestinian cities and villages. A fresh escalation erupted after Palestinian gunmen, angry over the regime's crimes and occupation, killed 11 Israelis in separate attacks. That's the sharpest spike in attacks on city streets in years. On Tuesday, a Palestinian shot dead five people in a suburb of Tel Aviv before he was killed by Israeli forces. The operation came days after two Palestinian gunmen killed two Israeli forces and wounded four others in a shooting attack in the northern Israeli city of Hadera before being shot dead. The latest round of escalations could lead to igniting another war between Israel and Palestine. Last year, protests against the illegal eviction of Palestinians from the homes in the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah during Ramadan ignited an 11-day Israeli offensive on Gaza in May. At least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children, were killed in the Israeli bombardment. On the Israeli side, 12 people, including two children, were killed.
What's needed in order to do real resistance there is to make Israel extremely uncomfortable, and to the extent that they have to change their policies, or basically just hopefully it'll be so uncomfortable that they'll have to leave, which is of course what happened in Zimbabwe, the former Rhodesia, and in Algeria. The occupier left, and this needs to be the goal for Palestinians in order to the goal of their resistance.
The Israeli regime has for years guaranteed its security by attacking Palestinians, but now things have changed and Palestinian people and resistance groups are ready to retaliate.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. This is the part of a speech delivered on March 10th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. Once I spoke in details about national self-confidence, another element is the solidity of national faith. There are certain principles which our people believe in. This faith caused our people to stand up against the bullets of the Taghuti regime's military and overthrow the regime during a time when they did not have any weapons. In most cases, they did not even have stones to throw. That was due to faith. National faith is a really valuable asset. The preservation of national faith is one of the assets that is related to the people. Other elements include public welfare and smoothness of social matters. Mr. President, explained your opinions as voiced in the annual meeting of the Assembly. One important issue in the management of the country and the public life of the people is for the facilitation of their issues. They must not face hurdles and obstacles.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
For instance, the honorable officials of the country decided to create a consolidated window for investment and business affairs. Such measures are good. Affairs must be carried out smoothly and easily. These are matters that concern the people. If these things are done, the people's presence on the scene will be ensured. That is, if we can resolve these matters that are directly related to the people, then their presence on the scene will be 100%. Of course, despite the fact that we have certain problems right now, the people are present on the scene. Even in the 1980s, during the sacred defense era, when there were many problems, the people were present on the scene. There is no doubt about this. But if these things are resolved, the people will unanimously be present on the scene. And when people show their presence, no country and nation will have any concern and fear of anybody. Because the people's presence is very important, and because their presence is dependent on such matters. You can see how big and small devils are trying to deceive the people.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
In the limelight.
Just over a month into year three of the COVID-19 pandemic, research revealed recently that life expectancy in the United States declined again in 2021. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading Drop in Life Expectancy Speaks Volumes About How U.S. Handled COVID, expert says. Here's the details. Just over a month into year three of the COVID-19 pandemic, research revealed recently that life expectancy in the United States declined again in 2021, which followed a well-documented drop in 2020 and contrasted a recovery trend in other high-income countries. The paper, which has not yet been peer-reviewed, shows that U.S. life expectancy fell from 78.86 years in 2019 to 76.99 years in 2020 and 76.60 years in 2021, a net loss of 2.26 years. The study comes as progressives in Congress continue to fight for Medicare for All legislation to replace the U.S. for-profit healthcare system, one in which 112 million adults struggle to afford care, according to Gallup and Wealth Health. The research also comes just days after a Poor People's Campaign analysis exposed how the public health crisis was twice as deadly in poor countries as in healthy ones and exacerbated pre-existing social and economic disparities that have long festered in the United States. Johns Hopkins University's case tracker reported that recently, COVID-19 had claimed 984,571 lives across the United States of America, or nearly 16% of the more than 6 million deaths globally. Dr. Stephen Wolf, co-author of the new study and director emeritus of the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University, said in a statement that we already knew that the U.S. experienced historic losses in life expectancy in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic. What wasn't clear is what happened in 2021. Early in 2021, knowing an excellent vaccine was being distributed, I was hopeful that the U.S. could recover some of its historic losses, said Wolf, adding, but I began to worry more when I saw what happened as the year unfolded. He said, even so, as a scientist, until I saw the data, it remained an open question how U.S. life expectancy for that year would be affected. It was shocking to see that U.S. life expectancy, rather than having rebounded, had dropped even further. In addition to examining the United States, the researchers looked at life expectancy over the past 2 years in 19 peer countries and found a smaller drop between 2019 and 2020, an average of 57/10 years, followed by an average 28/10 year increase from 2020 to 2021. While other high-income countries saw their life expectancy increase in 2021, recovering about half of their losses, U.S. life expectancy continued to fall, Wolf said, adding, this speaks volumes about the life consequences of how the U.S. handled the pandemic. taking aim at policymakers who opposed efforts to curb the spread of the virus. The expert added that in a country where U.S. Constitution and 10th Amendment grant public health authority to the states, I believe the U.S. catastrophe speaks volumes about the policies and behaviors of U.S. governors, at least some of them. A highly effective vaccine was available in 2021 that made COVID-19 deaths almost completely preventable. Wolf highlighted that while the Delta and Omicron variants significantly contributed to the death toll in the United States, those mutations also impacted other countries that saw life expectancy rates rebound last year. He said deaths from these variants occurred almost entirely among unvaccinated people. What happened in the U.S. is less about the variants than the levels of resistance to vaccination and the public's rejection of practices such as masking and mandates to reduce viral transmission. Noting high rates of heart disease and obesity as well as inequities in access to healthcare in the United States, lead author and University of Colorado Boulder sociology professor Ryan Master said that those same factors made the U.S. more vulnerable than other countries to the mortality consequences of COVID-19. The study states that over a two-year period between 2019 and 2021, U.S. Hispanic and non-Hispanic black populations experienced the largest losses in life expectancy, reflecting the legacy of systematic racism and inadequacies in the U.S. handling of the pandemic. Wolf said that sadly, it was not a surprise to see the disproportionate impact on people of color. Our research had shown previously, but there was an interesting plot twist in 2021. The only decrease in life expectancy occurred in white people. Life expectancy in the black population even increased. Despite that increase, he pointed out, life expectancy in the black population remains far lower than in other groups, but the disproportionate impact on white people holds clues to what happened in 2021. Co-author Ladan Aron, a senior fellow at Urban Institute, told the Washington Post, "It's hard to imagine that willingness to be vaccinated is not a piece of that puzzle. The life expectancy gap between the United States and its peer income countries is now over 5 years, which is an incredible gap," she said. Death and life expectancy? That's the ultimate marker of what it means to live in a country. The new research comes after a March study published in the journal Population and Development Review, which found that global life expectancy appears to have declined by 92 tenth years between 2019 and 2020, and by another 72 tenth years between 2020 and 2021. Changes in life expectancy between 2019 and 2020 in America, Europe, and a few other countries have received copious attention.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As voters go to the first-round presidential polls this weekend, many French Muslims no longer see Emmanuel Macron as the centrist which he claimed to be in 2017. If Nicolas Sarkozy introduced Islamophobia and François Hollande made it acceptable to the mainstream, Macron's term institutionalized Islamophobia. Macron immediately took Hollande's multi-year state of emergency and legalized it, with Muslims the clear targets and practically the only victims. His so-called anti-separatist law of 2021 tried to ban the hijab for minors and clearly violated constitutional protections for the freedom of association, worship, and politics. It was so heavy-handed, even the United Nations and English language media widely criticized it.
Emmanuel Macron lance son projet sur le séparatisme.
When Macron launched his anti-separatism law, which hurt Muslims so badly, it was a clear bid to join the far right. We saw that he was using their same ideas and preferred methods, and that he was doing it in broad daylight.
In the months preceding the election, nearly 100 mosques have been raided, with at least 24 shut down so far. Top Muslim NGOs and local community centers have also been exiled or closed. A new report revealed that these closures were based merely on secretive evidence, which is to say no evidence was ever produced in court.
Sur la radicalisation, on a entendu de tout et n'importe quoi.
His government has produced so much nonsense, like when they said having a beard was a sign of being a radical Muslim or taking Ramadan seriously. His politics are clearly identity politics, and that's a real danger. His objective is to have a seat at the table with the other far-right politicians.
Not apologizing for massacres during the war against Algerian independence, keeping the Arab Nelson Mandela, Georges Ibrahim Abdullah, in prison, enacting legislation which falsely equates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, gutting social services and help for poor, largely immigrant areas. Many Muslims say they are prepared to vote against Macron in the second round, whomever the candidate. In 2012, 93% of over 2 million Muslim voters picked Hollande over Sarkozy, providing the decisive margin in an extremely tight contest. In 2022, Muslims may play a similar role of kingmaker, but it's still not sure which side they will pick. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
After an hours-long manhunt throughout Tel Aviv, Israeli forces clashed with Raad Hazem and killed him in Yaffa. 28-year-old Raad Hazem from Jenin refugee camp in the north of the occupied West Bank was the Palestinian man who opened fire in Dezengoff shopping street in central Tel Aviv Thursday night, killing two Israelis and wounding nine others. The Palestinian resistance groups praised the operation, describing it as heroic. Hamas resistance groups said it proves resistance is continuing and escalating, while the Islamic Jihad said the operation confirmed how fragile the Israeli regime is.
The assassination of any Palestinian, Tel Aviv's crimes, and aggression on Al-Aqsa Mosque is responded by more heroic operations. So it's a natural and legitimate response. Israel must expect that any future steps or crimes would definitely drag such reactions.
Following the operation, more than 1,000 police officers joined a manhunt, while the Israeli settlers were ordered to get off the streets and remain at home. Experts say the operation that was the latest string of deadly operations across the occupied territories and the fourth in 2.5 weeks had confused the Israeli regime and proved its weakness.
This operation in particular has really shocked the Israeli society, and the Israeli regime is broken on all levels, even the security level, because they deal with the Palestinian as a security problem and not people having political and historic rights. This operation is telling them that Palestinians exist as real owners and they have a right in these lands.
Meanwhile, Israeli military has declared its forces will be on high alert in Al-Quds for the first Friday prayers of the holy month of Ramadan. The Israeli police bolstered their forces in Al-Quds, and more troops have stationed on the numerous checkpoints in the occupied West Bank, imposing more strict measures against the Palestinians. Palestinians say the Israeli military thought its crackdown and aggression following the March 22nd operation that claimed four Israeli lives led to a state of calm in the occupied territories. However, Raad Hazem's Thursday attack that killed two more Israelis reminded the regime that the entire Palestinian lands are occupied and that the resistance continues. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
One of the men is Britain's monarch in waiting. The other is one of the UK's most prolific paedophiles and abusers, a public figure who used his influence to groom and attack on suspecting victims. Now, in a series of bombshell revelations,